This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. When I'm near the end of writing any big article, I often feel excited about finishing it and getting it out into the world. But over the years, I've learned to pace myself in a way that works for me. If I step away from the draft and come back to it with fresh eyes the next day, I'll almost always find ways to improve it. Now let's apply that idea in another way. Rehydrate in a way that works for you with Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier, which has 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, 8 vitamins and nutrients in every stick, and comes in all kinds of flavors. Passion fruit, tropical punch, strawberry, the list goes on. I'm a lemon-lime guy myself. Whether you've just finished a workout or traveling, or maybe you just have a long day ahead, Liquid IV can help you recharge or prepare for what's coming your way. And it's super easy. You just tear the packet open, pour it in your water, mix it up, and that's it. If you're like me and you sit in front of a screen all day and then you watch a bunch of movies and TV at night, we could all probably benefit from drinking more water. But just 1 stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water actually hydrates better than water alone. Rehydrate with better hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions of dollars by pulling your personal data off the internet and selling it without your consent. Data brokers are selling your name, address, phone number, and more to marketers, scammers, basically anyone who's willing to pay for it. But Aura helps you fight back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off, and they alert you quickly if your information shows up in some kind of breach. But Aura is more than just data broker removal. In one simple app, Aura gives you a full digital security suite, including a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers before they can reach you. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. And if your identity does ever get stolen, you're backed by up to $5 million in insurance and 24/7 US-based fraud support to help you recover quickly. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That is enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove to get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's 2026. We made it. The new year doesn't require a whole new you, but wouldn't it be nice to feel a little less weighed down? Therapy can help more easily identify all the things that might be holding you back from reaching your goals or being your ideal self. We all have obstacles to overcome. Personally, I'm working on trying not to hold grudges. That's a big one for me. I hang on to grudges sometimes for years. And I know that's probably not the best way to move through life. BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms. With over 30,000 fully licensed therapists who have served more than 5 million people around the world, it really works. And it has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, January 21st, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we'll talk a little about the latest film and TV news. We'll talk about the new Netflix cop thriller, The Rip. We'll present an interview with that movie's director, Joe Carnahan. And then we'll talk about 28 years later, The Bone Temple. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And the fate of Warner Brothers continues to hang in the balance between Netflix, which has a signed deal to acquire the company, and Paramount, which is just not giving up this fight. So again, this is going to be a very, very long process here. We're still not exactly sure how it's going to play out. But if Netflix does end up being successful in acquiring Warner Brothers, Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO of Netflix, is committing to a 45-day theatrical window for Warner Brothers movies. Again, we can take him at his word here. We can say this is what he's saying right now, but we're not sure how it's going to play out down the road. But I just figured it was worth bringing to your attention some of these quotes here. So this comes from a YouTube video that Netflix released for their fourth quarter earnings report or something. I'm not entirely sure. But Deadline has these quotes where Sarando says, "I have in the past made observations about the theatrical business. We were not in the theatrical business when I made those observations. When this deal closes, we will be in the theatrical business." So he says, this is a business and not a religion. So conditions change and insights change. And we have a culture that we reevaluate things when they do. He talks about when this deal closes, we'll have the benefit of having a scaled world-class distribution business with more than $4 billion at the global box office. We're excited to maintain it and strengthen that business. Warner Brothers films will be released in theaters with a 45-day window, just like they are today. So again, whether or not we choose to believe him, it's immaterial, really. But I guess it's somewhat notable that he's making these comments, because he's certainly trying to quell some of the unrest that has popped up in the industry because of the assumptions a lot of people made based on his previous comments about what this could do to the theatrical industry as a whole. So I hope if this goes through that he follows through on his word, and that's all I can say about that for now. I'm sure we'll bring more updates on that whole situation as they come. Speaking of Netflix updates, they have re-upped their deal with Sony Pictures. I believe they're paying them something like around $7 billion for the ability to license Sony Pictures movies in that first streaming window on Netflix, which has been the case for several years. The deal, I believe, is going to be a global deal instead of just in the United States and maybe a couple other territories as it is right now. So that's good news for, I suppose, Netflix subscribers who get access to these big theatrical Sony movies sooner than they would otherwise. And then that's absolutely good news for Sony, who does not have a streaming service of its own, but has made some questionable decisions in terms of what movies to greenlight. We're talking about Karate Kid Legends, things of that sort, and a $7 billion or thereabouts infusion into their company is probably a good thing for them. So that's that. Next up, the God of War TV series that Amazon Prime Video is working on has found its Kratos, who is the lead character of that video game franchise. This TV adaptation is going to be brought to life by Ronald D. Moore from Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica. And now we know that Ryan Hurst is going to be playing Kratos in this show. Ryan Hurst played Thor in God of War Ragnarok from 2018. So he has some familiarity with this franchise, and that's kind of a cool little in-universe casting switcheroo, or whatever you might want to call that. He definitely has the approval of Christopher Judge, who voiced Kratos in the video game. So that's cool and a nice little moment for them. Speaking of TV adaptations of popular video games, we saw the first look of Sophie Turner from Game of Thrones in the role of Lara Croft in the TV adaptation of Tomb Raider that is coming to screens at some point soon. I believe that is filming right now. In addition to Sophie Turner, Sigourney Weaver, Jason Isaacs, Bill Patterson, people like this are going to be in the show, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge of Fleabag fame is the creator and co-showrunner with Chad Hodge. I believe it's an Amazon MGM Studios project, and I think I'm 99% sure this is going to Prime Video. I believe it's supposed to come out sometime next year, if I saw that correctly. In any case, I believe there are going to be more Tomb Raider video games that are coming out. One's coming out this year, and then another one is coming out next year. So stay tuned for that as well. From one Sophie Turner project to another, well, kind of. George R.R. Martin is talking about Game of Thrones again, the creator of the world of A Song of Ice and Fire, and he is behind the new show Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which is on HBO right now. It's a 6-episode adaptation of The Hedge Knight, which is the first novella in the Dunk and Egg series of books that he has published. George R. R. Martin said in a big profile for The Hollywood Reporter that he was planning to kill more people, more characters, than what we saw it at the end of Game of Thrones. I won't spoil that just in case people are catching up with that show. But he said, I was going to kill more people, not the ones they killed in the show. They made it more of a happy ending. I don't see a happy ending for, and then he says a certain character's name, which I won't ruin. His whole arc has been tragic from the first. I was going to have this other character die, but she's been so appealing in the show, maybe I'll let her live. So if you want to find out which characters he's talking about, I'm going to link to our story about this in the show notes so you can check that out directly. He's made some very interesting comments during the press rounds for Night of the Seven Kingdoms, especially about his relationship with Ryan Condal, who's the guy who runs House of the Dragon, the other HBO prequel series that is up and running right now. I think season 3 of that is coming later this year. But there's definitely a bunch of conflict behind the scenes between Condal and George R. R. Martin, and Martin is not afraid to talk about that. And then also in that, I believe it was in that same Hollywood Reporter profile, there's a mention of a potential Arya Stark TV show that is now in early stages of development, the Jon Snow series that was going to follow Kit Harington's character after the events of Game of Thrones is completely and totally and fully once and for all axed. Kit Harington has said that he does not want to come anywhere close to playing the Jon Snow character again. I guess he might not have had the best experience developing that potential spinoff, but in any case, it looks like they are talking about doing another show in the Game of Thrones universe, and this one might bring back Maisie Williams as Arya Stark. No deals have been signed. It's still very, very early, but I think this is the first time that we're hearing that a show centered around that character is like officially being written, or, you know, is in the early stages of actual development instead of just sort of a pie in the sky type of thing. Next up, Kenan and Kel, who I grew up watching on the Nickelodeon series Kenan and Kel. They were also in Good Burger, and I believe they got their start on All That, the kids sketch comedy series. They are reuniting on screen again for a movie called Kenan and Kel Meet Frankenstein, which is a horror comedy inspired by the classic Abbott and Costello monster films. And this one follows two delivery drivers whose routine drop-off takes a terrifying turn when they arrive at a creepy out-of-place castle and accidentally awaken Frankenstein's monster, turning an ordinary night into a fight for survival. So that sounds like kind of a fun project that will bring these two guys back. I mean, is this a pure nostalgia play in some ways? Yes, of course, but that doesn't mean that it's automatically going to be bad or without any value. So we'll see how that ends up, but just thought it was notable for my fellow people who grew up in the 90s and maybe have a soft spot in their hearts for Kenan and Kel. And then lastly, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to an article that Jacob Hall wrote for Slash Film talking about some of the changes that are coming to Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, which is the Star Wars themed land at the Disney parks. And I'm not super fluent in that world. I've never actually been to Galaxy's Edge, but Jacob knows all about that whole theme park space and writes really smartly about that. So there are talks of bringing original trilogy Star Wars characters to life in those parks, and Jacob has some thoughts there. So I'm going to link to that for anybody who is up on the world of theme park stuff. So that's all the news for this week. Since this is a relatively light episode of the show, we only have two movies that we're going to dig into here in just a minute. I did want to take this opportunity to talk for just a second about a really cool thing that I got in the mail the other day. So sometimes companies will send us stuff in the mail. We've talked about them on the show before. And this is one of the coolest things that I've gotten in a long, long time. So this company called Pirate Gold has teamed up with Lionsgate to make a John Wick themed poker set. And I actually have a monthly game running with a few of my friends. We've been doing this for the past several years, and I think this is going to go over really well when I play with them next month, because the set comes in this heavy-duty case. There are 250 clay chips, like casino-grade, really, really nice, high-quality chips in there. There are two decks. There's a black deck and a red deck of cards, and they are like themed to the world of John Wick. There's like all sorts of gun imagery and like stuff about, you know, Parabellum and like the high table and all of that. It also comes with 50 gold coins, which seems very appropriate for this particular licensing deal, because as you know, if you've seen the John Wick movies, a lot of characters pay for things in that universe with gold coins. So it's cool to feel like you're a part of that universe by having these gold coins as part of this poker set. I guess you could make them represent whatever denomination you want. That's like the highest thing, you know, could be like the most valuable thing on the poker table or something like that. And then the other thing that comes in any good poker set is some tokens. There's one for the dealer, there's one for a small blind, and one for a big blind. And this set has done it in a very, very interesting way where you have those separate things, but you can also screw them together and it almost looks like a silencer for a weapon of some kind. So very, very cool theming on this stuff, and everything is like incredibly high quality. And it also comes with a card that says Continental on it, and it has like a certificate of authenticity kind of thing on the back. So this is just a very, very cool thing for anybody who loves poker as I do, and then also has an affinity for film and television related stuff, specifically the John Wick universe. I think this is very slick and will be very impressive to any group that gets together to play poker on a regular basis. So check that out. If you're interested, you can find more information about that at pirategoldpoker.com. All right, let's get into our conversation about The Rip. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor and chief film critic, Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
All right, Chris, let's talk about The Rip. I was very excited when I saw the trailer for this movie, and I think you were too. I think you were kind of into this from the beginning. So what do you think about the movie itself?
Yeah, you know, I had hopes for this. I was ultimately let down by it. You know, I like some of Joe Carnahan's movies. Some of them are like hit or miss for me, but like Narc is like his big breakout movie, and I thought that was very good. And you know, he's got a certain like gritty style that I appreciate. And I really like the idea of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck reuniting for a, you know, a cop thriller movie. You know, they had previously reunited for The Last Duel, which I think is a really great underrated movie. It did not do well at the box office, even though I think it's one of Ridley Scott's better later films. But the idea of them like, you know, riffing on each other and playing cops, I was like, oh, this will be cool. And I just thought the movie was kind of dull. They spend most of the movie like at each other's throats, which I just think is like a bad use of these actors. Like I would much rather see them, you know, being dudes. You know, I don't like when people criticize movies for what they wanted the movie to be, because I feel like, you know, you have to take a movie on what it is rather than what you were hoping it to be. So, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but even like watching the movie as it is, I just found it kind of boring. Like they spend the majority of the movie at like this one location, and you can make that work. Like John Carpenter famously made that work with like Assault on Precinct 13. And I thought that might be what they were kind of trying to do here, but not really. I don't know. It just felt like weirdly inert to me. Like there's like characters and they sit around and eventually there's a few shootouts, but like, it was lacking an energy that I felt like it really needed. And I also really easily figured out like what they were trying. Like there's a twist near the end. And I was like, I picked up on what they were trying to do very early in the movie. And I kind of don't like when that happens, because I'm just like, oh, okay. I hope I didn't easily solve this, but I easily did. Also, the movie is set in Miami, which it never feels like I have a specific idea of what Miami, I'm sure you do too, because you live in Florida, but when I think of movies set in Miami, I think of them looking a certain way. And for this, like, it just never feels like that. Like it's always like raining and miserable in this movie. And I'm just like, is this really what you like? Why is this set in Miami? They could have set this like in Seattle or something. Like,
I mean, I think they set it in Miami because this is based on true events to some degree. I mean, I think they really did find a bunch of money in a house in Miami that was sort of serving as this stash house type of thing. So I'm guessing that's why they set it there. The look of the movie was probably the thing that bothered me the most. I thought it was exceptionally dark. Like even interior scenes, the very beginning of the movie, there's this interrogation that happens, and it's like a true detective style cross-cutting across different interrogations that are happening in the same room. And it's like they completely forgot to turn the lights on in the room. I'm like, is this supposed to represent, you know, like the dark underbelly of these guys and like the potential corrupt nature of the police and whatever? If so, it's not really working. It just kind of looks like everyone did a bad job, you know what I mean? And then like even there's an outdoor scene right after that where they're outside at the police station. And yeah, as you mentioned, this movie is set in Florida. It should be like really bright and sunny. And of course, there's plenty of rain here. But even the outdoor scene outside at the police station, they're like sitting in the shade, and like everyone is sort of bathed in darkness that way. And then Kyle Chandler's character, who plays like some sort of different law enforcement agent, rolls up, and they're all kind of in the light or whatever. And like this crew that Affleck and Damon's characters are on are sort of like still shaded. And I'm like, again, this seems like pretty heavy handed. And like, I guess you could justify it because it's friggin' hot in Florida. So maybe if people are hanging out outside, they don't want to be in the full blast of the sun. But these are like small things that I think a lot of people probably aren't thinking about, but I was thinking about because I was distracted by them and I wasn't fully sucked into the story as much as I wanted to be. So
yeah, I'm right there with you. Like, I just like, and it's also like, we've seen this kind of movie before. Like, I guess I was just hoping for something different. Like, it's one thing if you're going to do like a sort of like by the numbers cop thriller, like there, you can do something with that. You can, you know, there's a sort of like familiarity and like almost like a nostalgia to that. Like, I'm sure you could find a way to do that, but I don't know, just like this felt very like limp to me. Like, where they were just like, I kept waiting for this to be better than it was. I was like, All right, any minute now, it's going to turn into like something better. And it never feels, it feels very much like a pilot for like a Law and Order spinoff or something. It never feels like a cool movie to me. And like, it just feels like a waste of everyone's talents. Cause like everyone involved with this is pretty talented. I mean, Affleck and Damon are really cool guys, and Tina Taylor, who just like sort of broke up big with One Battle After Another, she's in this, and like, you know, Steven Yeun is in this, like, but none of them feel like they're doing much. I don't know. I came away being like, oh, that's it, huh? Like, I don't know. Like, you gotta give me something, you know? You gotta give me like either like really cool action, which this doesn't have, or really cool characters, which this also doesn't have. So it's like, what are we watching this for? Like, you know, like, I don't know. Like, you gotta give me something here.
Well, I think I liked the movie a little bit more than you do, but I understand what you mean, because I mean, I certainly didn't love it. I just kind of came away being like, okay, that was fine. I do want to talk about the ending of the movie, though. So I'm going to put a spoiler warning here. If you've not seen The Rip, check it out. It's streaming on Netflix right now. And then come back and listen to the rest of this conversation. I had an interview with Joe Carnahan that I'll play in just a minute. And we get into some spoilers in that as well. But okay, final warning for spoilers. The one component that I did enjoy was sort of the reveal that Affleck and Damon's characters were working together for most of this movie, even though the audience doesn't fully know it. But Chris, is the way that you were able to pinpoint the twist in advance, is that because every time Damon's character would say a number, it would be different, and like you picked up on that early? And that, I feel like the movie is like expecting us not to pay close enough attention to those moments along the way, and like he's doing that to kind of flush out a rat in the unit, and that's a big reveal at the end of the film where he's like, I told everybody a different number, and that's how it all happened, or whatever. Is that how you picked up on that?
Yeah, I picked up, it's that, and also just the way the Damon character acts through the whole movie. Like, he's acting very shady, but he's acting shady in a way where you're like, all right, he's clearly not a bad guy. Like, I kind of wish the movie had more teeth to it, and like was all in on making the Damon and Affleck characters like bad guy. Like, I think I could relate more to a movie where it's like, because early, like, they said this whole thing where Matt Damon's character like is in medical debt because his son died of cancer, and I kind of would respect the movie more if it really was about crooked cops, because like I could buy into that more than like they're actually like these noble cops who want to stop the crooked cops. It's like, in this day and age, I just don't really buy that anymore. You know, I'm not really in the mood for a movie about like noble cops anymore. Like, I think we've moved beyond that. Like, you know, I just think Matt Damon is a very specific kind of actor where I can't really buy him as a bad guy, and the movie keeps trying to be like, maybe he's a bad guy, and I'm like, well, obviously he's not gonna be a bad guy. so it's like, I was like the fact that he was like acting very shady. There's also that one scene where like it's very obvious he wants Sasha Kale's character to overhear him, where like he goes into the garage, he's like, listen up guys, I want to steal this money. I was just like, all right, like there's no way he would just like come out and say that. So there's clearly something going on here. Yeah.
I agree that there are several moments where it just kind of felt middling at best, and like a better version of this movie might have been able to execute some of these ideas a little bit more smoothly or something. I did find it very satisfying in that big speech where Damon at the end was talking about how lying is an art and he's an artist for doing it so well and stuff. Like, it kind of gave me that, like, you know, Damon Affleck movie star energy. And this movie, it kind of has, like, it's not a very fun movie overall, but there is some fun to be had with, like, these two characters kind of brushing up against each other. Because, as you said, Damon is depicted to be this guy who, like, might be crooked, and Affleck's character is supposed to be sort of the straight shooter, rule follower character. And the two of them are almost jostling for power in the movie, like who's going to take control of this crime scene. And I thought it was like an interesting little meta component of like the two of them maybe jostling for star power within the movie itself. So there's like some fun stuff here. And like Kyle Chandler is like portrayed as like this golden boy character, and then he ends up being sort of a slimy piece of shit by the end of it. And like, I thought he kind of had fun chewing on it, but there's just like not that much to that character. And like, he doesn't really get any big satisfying monologues, or like, as you mentioned, the action is just kind of okay. So like, you can't even really coast by on that. So it's just like a lot of like okay stuff and like some pretty interesting highlights, but overall I just came away being like, oh yeah, I mean, that was fine. So
yeah, it's just like, I like you said, like I wish it were more like fun, for lack of a better term. Like, all the marketing is playing up the, you know, it's Affleck and Damon and they're buddies and they're joking around and stuff. And there's very little of that in the movie. Like, I'd rather that be like, I'd rather see these guys, like, they can still be at each other's throats, but I'd rather see them like having fun than like, the movie is so like dour and gloomy. And it's like, I just feel like the pieces are here for something much better than what we got. And it's a bummer. Like, we could have gotten like if you're going to make a crime thriller with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, let them do more than what they're doing here, you know, instead of just like standing around wearing tactical vests, looking unhappy. Like,
yeah. Well, it's a little unfortunate because I like Joe Carnahan as a person, as you'll hear in my interview with him. He's like a very gregarious guy, very like upbeat and friendly. And it seems like everybody went into this with the best of intentions, and then the movie itself just kind of came out only okay. But he is one of these mid-budget action directors that I think actually, when he gets a hold of a good script, can typically turn something in that is very entertaining and satisfying. And this is like right on the edge of that for me. But I think he has a lot of interesting insights into what went into making this movie and working with Damon Affleck and the larger state of mid-budget action in Hollywood right now. So here is my conversation with Joe Carnahan. One more thing before we jump in. During the interview, we allude to a deal that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's company, Artist Equity, made with Netflix, which is a one-off deal that goes against Netflix's typical business model. Traditionally, the streamer has paid everyone a lump sum up front, but for this movie, there are incentives built in where every member of the crew, which is around like 1,200 people, will receive a bonus if the movie performs well. This business is changing, Affleck said in a recent interview with Variety, and in order to maintain the integrity of it and to provide the decent middle-class wages it's provided for decades in this country, you have to have compensation that works for people. There's no guarantee that you're going to get rich and be successful, but if you work on a project and you are successful, you ought to benefit in that. So that was his quote, and I just wanted to provide a little bit of context for that as we get into the interview here. I want to ask you something very specific right at the top here. Sure. So there's a scene where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon's characters are speaking with a cartel leader on the phone, and we see subtitles pop up on screen when the cartel head is speaking. But they pop up in this interesting way that I can't recall seeing before, almost like each letter is being spun through a translator before it appears on screen. It's a pretty subtle thing, but I thought it was really cool. Can you tell me
That's
about
great,
that?
Brother. Yeah, no, we thought it'd be kind of interesting to kind of just like, you know, like, because basically you're saying these two characters, Ben's characters, both speak Spanish. But I just thought it was kind of a cool little, you know, our effects guys did a really nice little job there of and again, you know, I love like the way Tony Scott would do like subtitles and like Man on Fire. I always thought that was so cool. And I think we just kind of throw it away sometimes. And I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So how would you characterize the overall experience of making The Rip compared to the rest of the movies that you've directed?
I got to say, Ben, like, I've never had a better time on set or felt kind of more supported. When I say better times, like, listen, we have fun on, you know, I've had fun on, we try to have fun on every set, and try to remind ourselves that, you know, we're lucky to be doing this and let's just enjoy the process and so on. But, this was just, you know, to have their support, dude, and have that Artist Equity behind you and Netflix behind you and everybody kind of, you know, putting their best foot forward is it's the dream, man. It doesn't happen often enough. So it was great.
So you mentioned Artist Equity, and I saw the news story a little while ago that there's like a slightly different deal being done with this movie compared to some other stuff. So were you a part of those discussions?
You know what? We knew about it early on. It was never kind of a headline thing that I think they put out there. We knew about it. I knew that the boys are pushing on that. And I think it's such a smart, and to kind of be at the vanguard of that, it makes sense for it to be Matt and Ben, because I think that they, you know, they've been doing this a long time at a very high level. And the idea of incentivizing a crew so that everybody, caterer, gaffer, you know, hair and makeup, the transpo guys, you know, that's huge. And you feel it, then it becomes a true communal experience, right? We're all kind of in this together, and it's not this separation of like, hey, the movie star and then everybody else. So the director and everybody else. It's like, I really think that that's tremendous. And I think it's also wonderful that Netflix is like, yeah, we get it, man. We understand where the business is going, and let's see what happens here. And let's see if it bears fruit.
Yeah. Could you feel a difference on the set compared to some other projects that you've worked on?
You know what you feel, brother? You just know that you're in good hands. And I think a lot of times I've had to be like, you know, I've had to do like five jobs. And in this one, I just had to do one. And so that was the biggest thing, is that, and then what you get in those instances is like, you know, Juanmi Asprez, my DP, and Kevin Hale, my editor, like these guys I've worked with on many, many films. It allows us to do our best work because we're not multitasking, because we have to make up for, okay, well, these guys know what the hell they're doing. And, you know, and that happens sometimes. Listen, I've only made four movies really inside the studio system. The five, including this one. And they're rough, you know, when you're out there in the world, you know, trying to put these indie, you know, movies together. It's tricky, dude. And I don't want to do them like that anymore. You know, I want to say, walking around that after party last night, I was like, oh, I could do a lot more of this. This is great.
So I'd like to talk about a spoilery moment, but we're going to hold this until the movie comes out. Sure. So feel free to speak openly. So at the end of the movie, we find out that Damon and Affleck's characters have been working together to find the rat in their group. And yes, Damon gets to give this, it's kind of this movie's version of like a how do you like them apples kind of speech,
right,
which is
right,
just,
right.
It's so satisfying as an audience member to watch that. So I was hoping you could talk me through getting to that moment, making it feel earned from a story perspective, and then actually working with Damon to get what you wanted out of him performance-wise.
That's a great question, Ben. I think that was, it's a kind of a trite thing to say, but it really all begins with the script, right? And I don't particularly think I don't have an affinity for this type of writing, which is the kind of, so I'm always amazed. Like I watch Rian Johnson, I'm going, this guy, this is fucking fantastic. This is a magic trick, you know? So we spent a lot of time kind of, you know, drilling down, myself and Mike McGrail, drilling down on what the specifics of that would be, and really spent a lot of time in the outline phase. Right. So when you get there, you know, cause you are, dude, you're building a watch. This thing has to keep time, and it has to hit at seconds and hit at particular moments. And again, so in that, it was so great because Matt now embodies the here it comes, you know, and it really begins with, you know, these guys are just staring each other down and the guns come out, right? And I also want to, Ben, I don't want to wind up in some Reddit thread where some guy goes, well, why didn't you just kill him when they got in the car? They should have killed him right away. They have their weapons out. They know what's going on, right? So now it's going to be very difficult. Okay, what do we do? If they're the bad guys, how do we make a move on these guys, right? So that was number one. And then you think these guns are designed, this kind of standoff for the two of them. And it's not until there's a very deliberate camera move where Ben leans forward and now it's like, wait a minute. It reframes and now Roe is the subject of the scrutiny. And now, you know, wait a minute. What's going on here, right? So that when he says, you know, bullshit everybody, you know, don't, and it's like, you know, unless you're lying like me, which that's a fucking art form. And I've been lying to you all night. I love that moment. And I loved, you could see, you could feel in the audience last night, this palpable kind of glee, like, oh, wait a minute. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
Jason Bourne's not a bad guy. Batman's not a bad guy, you know? So it was deeply satisfying, brother. And it's so funny that that's the moment you go, okay, it's like, you want to have those, you want to give an audience those great moments, those wins. I love that. I do. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Yeah. So as soon as I finished watching the movie, I immediately went to search about the real story that this was based on and didn't really find that many details. I just kind of saw, like, you know, some arrests were made, there was money in the house, and that was kind of it. Like, did you guys have more access with the research that you were able to do into some more of the specifics of what actually happened here? Or did you guys just kind of take that basic framework of the news story and say, this is a cool idea, let's completely invent a bunch of stuff, you know, to happen here?
Disgusting. I was actually involved in that rip. And so he was able to fill in a lot and give us a lot more color in terms of those details. And like a little one is like, you know, that when in the actual rip, which took 42 hours to count, dude, which we, you know, obviously we're not going to do a 20 part series on this thing and watch him count for 42 hours. But when they got to the DEA held, there's an actual DEA held Wells Fargo. It's a real place. And there was a guy with a clipboard waiting for him and six armed men. And they excused the other two officers, put them in Ubers. That's all true. And then they used it like a two-story counter, this giant electronic counter. So that moment, Ben, where the readout is $20 million and the card is, that actually happened. So there's stuff in there that we stayed true to the authenticity of it. And then, as you mentioned, it's like, then you got to invent the rest of it, man. You got to invent all the little pinwheels and the Rube Goldberg like contraption that eventually, you know, drops a net over the mouse. So, but we did have a little more insight into that than somebody who's just reading about it.
Yeah. Tell me about working with Ben and Matt as performers. Obviously you've worked with Affleck before, but what was it like just teaming up with these guys and really collaborating with them? I mean, they're such forces in the film world.
Yeah. I mean, you've got, again, I think, and the movie really trades on these two very, very distinct things, which is you got two guys who've been friends since they're kids, which is one thing. And then you've got two guys that also became movie stars, which is like the double unicorn. You know what I mean? Like, when does that happen? How does that happen? So, at times it's a very kind of, they're interwoven. Like, you see Matt and Ben is Matt and Ben, like when they're upstairs and they've just discovered the money in the wall, and Ben's like, dude, it's me. It's just you and me. That's Matt and Ben. You know what I mean? And like, you're getting this great kind of gravitational sense of, you know, like their hold on an audience of 30 plus years of being in this business and seeing their faces on screen and seeing them, you know, knowing their history, and the two of them winning an Oscar when they're kids, and, you know, like all this, there's a lot of goodwill and a very endearing quality to that. And then you also happen to have two real, like, world-class filmmakers, guys who just know the inner workings and how the machines function and give you the grace and the support and the room you need to be great, you know, to really do your job at a very high level.
Yeah. I was going to ask if they felt deferential to you, or if they came up to you and were like, hey, maybe, you know, we should do things this way. Like, what was the vibe like between you guys?
Discussions were like, dude, you think we need this line? I don't know if we need this line, or, you know, it's like, and invariably they were always great suggestions. They never intruded on the process, you know. Like, Matt made a joke with me one day. I said, dude, you mind doing this? Hey, Carney, I'll pull faces for you all day, pal. I'm like, I'm here for you. I'm the boss, you know, I'm the studio, but I'll pull faces on whatever you need me to do. And it's like, he's being funny, but like, you know, Matt's the guy that hangs around and does his own hand inserts. Like, you're shooting his hand, because I said, well, dude, you know, go home. He's like, no, man, this is what they pay me for. You know, that there's a consummate professionalism to both of those guys that is so inspiring and sends the right kind of ripples out across that lake. That's like, oh, okay, we're all doing this for the right reasons with the right people.
So if I have the timeline right, you guys wrote the script and then you cast Ben and Matt. Was that correct, or did you have them in mind when you were writing?
Yeah, I wrote this, by the way, 2 years ago. This script did not exist. It didn't exist till May of 2024. And Danny Bernfeld, who is at Artist Equity, who's really the angel behind, you know, she's just really the wonderful ignition on this thing. Cause I had been in there. I talked to Ben about some stuff. We talked about, you know, all of us kind of figured it's something to work on and so on. And when that was done, Danny's like, listen, just give me 48 hours before it goes out in a larger context. Give me 48 hours with this movie. Let me figure it out. And 24 hours later I had Matt, and 24 hours after that I had Ben. And it was funny because, you know, they're producing it, obviously. And they go, well, you know, let's talk about cast. Who do you see in the movie? I go, well, you know, you guys would be okay. I don't know. What do you think? Maybe you guys is perfect casting, you know? So, honestly, Ben, we were just off to the races, man. It happened very quickly. We were done shooting that movie by the end of 2024.
Yeah. Wow.
Spent last year editing and fine tuning it and doing all that good stuff.
Did you have time to rewrite anything to their strengths, or was that all kind of like found on the day where you kind of create moments for them?
One little day of reshoots to kind of clarify some stuff, because I think we really were trying to hone this thing. So it was just like, it would just cut through anything. You know what I mean? Like we really, the story moves. And I think all the extraneous stuff that was the kind of we would find kind of, cumbersome after a while, we just kind of shore away slowly. And so that's what that process was. But there wasn't a lot of, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the very end and what that would look like. And that was a very different thing that went through a lot of iterations. And we finally got a version that we all love. That's the thing about the movie. It's like, it's the version I love. It's the version they love. It's the version Netflix loves. You know, it's not like we settled for everybody's second favorite choice, which sometimes happens in instances like these. You go, okay, well, this is the one we can agree on, so we'll let this, you know, you don't want that. You really want to probably can put your best foot forward.
Yeah, I was going to ask about different iterations of the story and like whether or not that process, that iterative process happened early or late. Like, was that in the edit or was that in the writing, like pre-production stuff? Like where, you know,
It's like, I always say this, like, there's three films. There's the one you write, the one you shoot, and the one you cut, right? They can be wildly divergent in what they wind up being. And so I think you just have to allow for the process to unfold, and you got to kind of, you know, there's a application you use, Frame.io, which Frame.io is basically, you know, you watch it, but you can make comments in specific moments, go, we need to do this here. Like, I think I was somewhere in the 13,000 range of individual comments on the various cuts over the 10 months or whatever, like, you know, because we just wanted to make this thing a rocket sled and really, you know, my girlfriend jokes about it. I get up at 3 a.m. and here we go. And we did it again and again and again and again and again. And Kevin Hale, my buddy, who I've known for 30 years, who cut the film early on, like, cause I realized I was being so abrasive, but he took a one note that I had said, and I just wrote like, flat, flat, flat. There is no narrative push here. There is no drive. This sucks. And it's like he says to his wife, "I don't think Joe's happy with this cut of the scene." So, no, dude. But we really, I mean, brother, when I tell you we roughed this thing up, like we really took this thing through its paces. We really knew what this movie was at the end of the day.
That's excellent. So you tend to make these really muscular, action-focused movies. What is it about that type of film that keeps you coming back?
You know what? I think that, you know, it's funny because I think I'd probably have a very different career if I just made Narc or The Gray, or like, I think, but like, my ex-wife said to me, it's like, I don't like your comedies, which is probably why she's my ex-wife, but I have an affinity for these things because I think that I love I think this movie is made and built from very intimate, kind of very human moments, whether it's the guys, whether again, it's, you know, Matt and Ben about talking about time and how much time has passed and what they're going to do with what they have left, or, you know, Catalina talking about just this little bit of money could change my life. And, you know, I like stuff like that, man. And I think the humanistic parts of it are the most important to me, because once Ben, you get an audience invested and they care about the characters they're seeing on screen and these people seem relatable to me, then you can really fuck with them. then you can put in all the, you know what I mean? All the contortions and all the twists and turns and all that stuff that you want from a narrative, from the dramatic standpoint, but to get them there. And then when violence does happen and this paroxysm of stuff takes place, it's truly shocking because now you care. You know, it's like, you know, Catalina laying there saying, you know, where's the dog? How's the dog? Is the dog hurt? That's her character. She's got a bullet in her leg. She's worried about where the dog is. And then conversely, the audience goes, oh my God, did they kill the dog? They kill the dog. It's like another layer of dread that you can hang on. So yeah, man, it's like, you want to feel like these types of movies are coming back into vogue. And again, I have nothing against superhero films. I have nothing against giant monsters. I love a lot of those. Those Marvel movies are fantastic. James Gray said something really brilliant recently. Like, you know, we're losing that. We've kind of mainstreamed this one type of tentpole kind of blockbuster film. So you lose stuff like this. So people say, well, don't you wish this was in theaters? Like, no, because streaming, because Netflix does allow for you to do these things. It does allow for these things to be a little different and varied.
It feels to me like, with a few exceptions, and I think your work and especially The Rip qualify as those exceptions, it really does kind of feel like Hollywood has lost the art of the mid-budget action movie. And I was wondering if you had any theories about that.
You know, brother, I think it's like, listen, because when you replace people that are genuinely film lovers and people understand the business and love to go to movies or love to make movies or love to experience movies, and you replace them with bean counters and bureaucrats and people that could care less because it's bottom line based, then you're going to get this. It's like, well, we have to talk to our shareholders. If everything's about shareholders, you're dead. You're just dead. You're going to invariably make a version of the same movie every time. And yeah. I don't have time for it. I don't have time. Talking about time and the importance of time. I don't want to waste 2 hours with something. I just saw this same thing, you know? So that to me is the great predicament that we're in. And I think movies like this, and I think we had a good year of films, solved that, because you see, listen, audience votes with their feet, man. They vote with their feet. Do they show up? Asses in seats. That's how they vote. Or number of streams. That's how they vote. So I think that you're seeing it. You're seeing the worm begin to turn here.
From the outside, it feels like it's a purposeful strategy on your part to make movies that never really seem to get bogged down with gigantic budgets. Yes. So that's my perspective from a viewer. Does it feel that way to you?
Yeah. I just didn't want to play. It's why Frank and I really started kind of war parties. Like, we wanted to be able to just go and do. I don't want to spend 2.5 years, 3 years on one movie. I just don't. I don't have that kind of. I like shooting shorter schedules with not a lot of, give me what I need to make the movie and then let us go make the movie. And listen, I'll put the action up in this film with anything that's been, you know, done recently. I think it's fantastic. Right. So, but I do believe, again, it's like, what's got to be a big swing. If it's not a big swing, it's got to be a micro budget. It's got to be a $5 million horror film. Or, like, again, those are the way that they've worked the economics in this business. And I think it's faulty and I think it has to change, but yeah, I don't want to be bogged down in that, dude. I don't want to have to deal with this slog of bureaucracy and, like, you know, well, this a junior executive thing. It's like, oh, come on, man. We got to get away from that stuff. You got to let filmmakers go make films.
Yeah, definitely. So you've been close to directing many projects over the years. You've talked a lot about Mission Impossible 3, but there was like Uncharted, Five Against a Bullet, Motorcade, Undying Love. And you don't really strike me as the type of guy who sits around wondering what could have been, because you stay pretty busy. But if you had to pick a project, is there anything that feels like the one that got away for you?
I wish I could have made Killing Pablo, because I spent a lot of time on that book and I really loved, and I thought I wrote a really good script and at the same time, you know, Jose Padilla and Wagner Moura come along and do Narcos, and it's like, well, that's dynamite. I can't even, you know what I mean? It's like, what do I do? You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
you can't complain, because they made something fantastic. But that was one I wish I could have, you know, like, God, I wish we could have just gotten in there and done that at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think my Death Wish script, which was even though I got credit for the Bruce Willis version, my script was nothing like that. And it remains probably the best thing I think I've written.
Oh, wow.
Take another shot at that one. That one, I would love another shot at that one, because that was a really, really specific movie that I wanted to make.
Do you think that's possible? I mean, with a few more years of distance between now or between that movie and I mean, is that even?
Yeah, the thing is, I don't even know that you need to call my death. It's like they're, it was so kind of it in and of itself, you know? I just called the guy Paul Kersey, but beyond that, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't think it was wildly different. It took place in LA. It was just a very different approach. And I'd like another at bat with that one.
Yeah. Do you think there's a chance that Nemesis ever sees the light of day?
Oh God. Well, listen, when you've got, when your plot is they're going to kill the president and that's something goes like that movie could be over in 30 seconds. It's like, yay. I think it's like, no, it's like, I think that, but I do think, cause I thought my brother and I wrote this really cool version. Cause I thought Mark's, graphic novel was great, but very thin. Like, okay, what if Bruce Wayne was the Joker, basically, is kind of the, you know, but I did think we did a really cool thing in there. And I think the idea of, you know, going in and starting to execute politicians is probably would play huge right now.
Yeah.
but again, that's another one that I think would be a lot of fun. How do you do that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're with a handful of directors swapping stories about wild moments on set, what's the story that you break out? Do you have like a favorite that you break out from your career?
You know, those I couldn't tell in mixed company because they're too specific. That's a really good question. I'll talk about this one about the rip that I just love because it was, I think it was, and we didn't, the shot didn't wind up in the movie, but I thought it was really great. Was I had, for the end of the film, I had all of Matt's kids and all of Ben's kids and their mothers and their loved ones and their wives and so on, yell for Jackie. So when they heard that the first time, they heard it coming from voices they knew. And there was this really great reaction that they had. And Ben said to me later, he goes, you know, Matt was like, I heard Ben's mom's voice. I was like, wait, are we in trouble? You know, it's like, but it's like, it kind of pierced the membrane for a moment, that fourth wall, like, who is that? You know what I mean? Like you could see it. And it's a bit of puzzlement. It's like, but I think they understood like what I was going for. You know, I'm like, I wanted to see what that would sound like if you heard your kids yelling that name and you recognize there's an immediate familiarity with that, you know.
Yeah.
Look like in your expression, which I thought was so cool. And I wish you could have kept the shot. You see a little bit of it, but not what it was.
Gotcha. So no film shoot ever goes exactly according to plan. Can you remember a time when things went wrong on this movie or some obstacle came up and you and your team had to figure out a solution?
Not with this one. I go to like boss level and give you like, you know, we lost 15 days of the schedule and it's like, okay, we ain't doing what we thought we were doing. And so now Frank has to just kill everybody with the minigun. You know what I mean? But they wound up being great. This was, again, Ben, this was such a joy because you've got these guys giving you everything you need. Again, within reason. It wasn't like we were extravagant and it's like, we're going to, you know, it's just money, money, money. It's like, no, here's the plan. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to execute it. Let's go do it. And that's all you want, man. It's just that mutual understanding. So, I wish there was like the hard scrabble. I think the truck going over the thing at the end was tricky because we knew we got one. We're doing it for real. This isn't CG. We're taking this thing over this overpass onto the thing, and it just went. It just chef's kissed. It was great.
A lot of this movie takes place at night, so it's pretty dark. But even some of the interiors are dark as well. And I was curious if you could tell me about your approach to lighting and like the overall look of the movie.
Juan, me and I spent a lot of time talking about light and shadow and color. You know, if you watch the movie and when you rewatch the movie and you want, if you know, to see how the sausage was made, right? It's like the green is obviously money. Red is Jackie's color. Even down the little girl at the end of the beach has a red scarf, her red scarf. Blue is the color of cops, right? So we're messing with those moments. And even like, again, when you say like, when Matt is giving that the moment, the kind of the penultimate thing before the big, it's just this flashing of red across him and Ben. This is all about Jackie, man. You know, so that we wanted there to be, and again, like at night, the darkness and playing with that darkness, that kind of inky darkness of candlelight and so on. But that the green as the movie progresses gets more and more emerald, like Oz, right? Like it's out there. It's like, this is the fantasy that I could take this money and this isn't real. So it was, we really, really spent a lot of time discussing, watching movies, looking at noir films, watching, you know, we like High and Low Kurosawa. If you watch, there's a lot of staging with deep focus and all the characters are in there. And stuff that we knew, like watch how these characters move inside this frame. It's really impressive. And then you're trying to, you know, replicate a sense of that. And also, but it's to feel very kind of verite and of the moment. So it's staged, but doesn't feel staged. But yeah, I think that, and I also think, you know, working at, it allowed us to be on stage during the day and still have the night shoot and really control and dial in the light with the kind of specificity that we wanted.
Yeah. Were there any other cinematic influences that you looked at aside from Kurosawa? What were some of those noir movies?
Thief, Soderbergh is so funny. Like we looked at like The Limey and we're like, too much, you know what I mean? Like, it's like too much, you know? So like what we were trying to do. What was another one we looked at? Like, I think with Fritz Lang, we looked at that because it's very noirish and very hard shadow, hard key light. And again, this is kind of de rigueur for kind of the way we approach this process. There's a lot of Todd Hedo, the photographer, we love his coffee table books and like love those, that look. Cause it's just so, there's a couple of wide shots in there. It's like, that's, it's like a Todd Hedo picture, you know, it's like, and we spoke to him, we got to talk to him, which is so great. Because the idea was like, have him come out and photograph this. We'll try to replicate what he's doing. But like, I think he'd be happy with what we did. But it was mostly that. And then the imagery that we go, that's perfect for this, you know?
That's very cool. All right. So I think I have time for one more question. When you think back on your experience making The Rip, what are you the most proud of?
I'm most proud of, I think that it all came together, that it's better than it was on the page. You know what I mean? That the movie wound up being better than the script. I think, and I'm most proud of just like how wonderfully heartfelt those performances are, you know, and how much I learned as a filmmaker and how much, you know, better I think we all are as a result of having this experience and knowing, okay, you know, we may have put this one in the center field bleachers. This is good. You know, we like this. So, but yeah, man. And again, just being able to still do it, dude, to still be able to work you can never take it for granted, you know? And of that, I'm extremely happy.
Excellent. Well, congrats. And thanks very much for the time today, man.
My pleasure, brother. Thank you, man.
And I just wanted this whole dunk fest in this movie. I do like Joe Carnahan, and I want to give a special shout out to The Gray, the Liam Neeson versus Wolves movie, which I think is probably his best movie. And I think it's very underrated because the marketing sold that as like another ass kicking Liam Neeson movie. And it's really not that at all. It's really this like dark meditation on death and dying. And I just think it's a really excellent film that did not get the praise it deserves. So Joe Carnahan, I forgive you for The Rip because I love The Gray.
Yeah, I think this year marks the 15th anniversary of The Gray. So if you have not seen that film, that's a good reason to check it out now. And I don't know if you remember the plane crash in that movie, Chris, but it's like one of the best cinematic plane crashes I've ever seen.
That's just a really good, upsetting movie. Like, you know, talking about tone, like that movie is nonstop bleakness. And yet I think that movie is genuinely great. Whereas The Rip is also bleak and I just found it kind of a chore. So it really, I guess it just depends on like the script or like the material.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much, Chris. I'm joined now by Slash Film editor, Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, it's time to enter the Bone Temple.
Bonesaw is ready.
Oh my God. You know, we were talking about you turning up your mic a little bit before we started recording, and now I regret having that.
Yeah, yeah. It was a trap. It was a trap the whole time.
So without spoiling anything, what did you think about Nia DaCosta's 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple?
Man, this movie is so good. And honestly, like, I feel like, you know, just both of these movies are so much better than they like have any right to be or anybody could have anticipated. And I feel like The Bone Temple honestly might even be better than the first 28 Years Later.
You are out of your mind, sir.
I don't know, man. I love the focus that we get on Ralph Fiennes' character. I like the development there. I also think the Jimmy gang is like totally unhinged and crazy and just, yeah, man, I don't know. I really liked what this movie did. It made it feel different than just, you know, your typical, you know, zombie horror action thriller, you know, because I think 28 Years Later is still very good. it still follows a pretty, you know, familiar formula as the other movies, you know, for as other zombie movies for the most part. And I feel like this really starts to veer away from that and digs into what makes like this series of stories unique.
Well, I guess we do have to spoil this. I'm sorry to set it up this way and then just kind of pull the rug out from under people. So yeah, we're just going to have to spoil 28 years later, The Bone Temple. If you haven't seen the movie, please pause this and then come back and check it out. So the reason you're saying that, Brad, I think, is because of the Ralph Fiennes and what's his name? Dr. Ian Kelson and yeah. Samson plotline, right? And like sort of how that unfolds.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a key part of it. But also having the gang of Jimmies feels very unique, too, because they're a little more than just a roving gang of people who are like, you know, are evil, because they have this like strange religious slant too, where they're worshiping Satan. And granted, like the leader of it, played by Jack O'Connell, you know, is totally fraudulent in what he's doing. And, you know, he's just taking advantage of people who are willing to, you know, believe and follow him, thinking that he's the son of the devil. But I really like that too, and that approach, especially the way that they have these crazy, you know, rituals that they do. And so that combined with Dr. Ian was great to me.
So I loved the Dr. Kelson and Samson stuff, and I wish the entire movie would have been that, because the Jimmy stuff really turned me off. I mean, I saw what they were trying to do by having Jack O'Connell's character be this cult-like figure, but I just felt like that whole group was so ill-defined to me. Like the individual characters, there was kind of nothing to a bunch of them. They felt really interchangeable to me for the most part. You got Spike in there and he's just trying to retain some sense of humanity amid all of this chaos that's happening around him. But I just feel like the engine of 28 years later, of Spike and his dad, and then Spike and his mom, you know, going out beyond the protection of their little island fortress almost, is such a better engine for a story than following these Jimmies around as they wreak chaos and do whatever they're going to do. And Spike just kind of like biding his time. And it just felt like the movie was really treading water for me, because you kind of knew at some point they were going to cross over with the Ralph Fiennes storyline. And it just felt like, let's get to it already. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so. But I feel like you could also kind of say the same thing about like that first movie too. It's like, because you've seen that story of like, oh yeah, the father and son are going out and the son's gotta learn the ways from the dad, and I'm sure something's gonna go wrong and he's gonna have to survive and figure stuff out, you know. So like the first movie is also, you know, follows a formula as well. So like I think I just really appreciated how much this diverged from that and did something different than what you would expect.
Yeah, I guess my defense, half-hearted though it may be, is that it kind of starts out and you think 28 years later is going to be all of this father and son thing, but that kind of gets pushed to the side pretty quickly and it more fully becomes a mother-son story.
Yeah.
And that was like the sort of subversion of what you would expect, I guess, in that movie. But yeah, I guess it's kind of like a to each his own type of situation with the Jimmies.
And again, the first 28 years later, still amazing. Like I don't think that like the Bone Temple is like, you know, a leaps and bounds improvement necessarily. I just appreciate the turn that it takes.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, were there any highlights of this movie that you wanted to mention here?
I love Dr. Ian as a character, just because he's such a dedicated like medical professional. He has a very calm personality in the way he approaches things. You know, I like that when he goes into like his little bunker, he's listening to records, you know, and just the way he deals with Samson is such a cool, you know, way to approach that. And just watching that evolution as he tries to figure out, you know, if there's still something ticking beneath the infected. That was easily my favorite part. And oh my God, so again, obviously we're in spoiler territory, but when Jack O'Connell's character, the leader of the Jimmies, Jimmy Crystal, as it were, he goes to talk to Dr. Ann because Aaron Kellyman's character, who's another one of the Jimmies, sees him dancing with Samson when he's in one of his like tranquilized states.
Yeah, drugged out stupors.
Yeah. And because they all are these Satan worshipers, she thinks that Dr. Ian might be the devil here on Earth because he's got the iodine red all over him, and they view the infected as demons. And so when she tells the lead, Jimmy, about this, they decide to go see him. And so Jimmy has to keep up this ruse and go talk to Dr. Ian. And in order for them to both create a symbiotic relationship where Jimmy won't kill Dr. Ian and Dr. Ian won't give up the idea that Jimmy is lying about being the son of the devil and everything, they concoct this plan to have Dr. Ian actually pretend that he's the devil. And the theatrical show that Dr. Ian puts on to pretend to be the devil is one of the coolest fucking things I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, it's so good, man. I really enjoyed that part of the film, especially like seeing Jimmy Crystal get his comeuppance and be crucified upside down and all of that. And like, yeah, there are several moments in this film that I thought were amazing. Like the, yeah, anytime Kelson and Samson are dancing, like there's even like a line of dialogue where during that scene you were just describing, Kelson says something like, pride flows through me like maggots through the corpse of a dead Christ or something yeah. like that. And I was like, man, like this movie has some juice at certain points. But you described the group as Satanists, and I know that that's like factually true, but I don't think the movie did a great job of communicating that. It didn't seem to me, I think maybe an improvement that I could make, you know, if I were to play Monday morning quarterback or something, is that like, I think the movie might have been a little bit more effective if I felt that the members of the Jimmies, beyond the leader, were actual believers in Satanism. You know what
well,
I mean?
Well, so it's interesting that you say that, and I get what you're saying, but and because I thought of that too. Like it seemed like I thought to myself, how could anybody buy into this? But it was Jimmy, the lead Jimmy's conversation with Kelson, that kind of keyed me into what the environment might be like for these people, because all of the other Jimmies are younger people. Mm-hmm. And so they've probably only grown up in this post-apocalyptic environment where the infected
really
ravaged the world. And so I imagine they've probably been away from their parents for most of the time they've grown up, probably very easily influenced. And even the lead Jimmy himself talks about how, you know, he was just a boy when everything happened too. So I take it to be like, it's a different world where people who are this young and were likely very easily influenced as children in a very scary world were very easily influenced because, and they found something to latch onto that helped made them feel protected and safe, even if it sounds completely crazy to us.
No, totally. And I get why they're with Jimmy. I just think what you just said is like even further underscores why I felt they should have been more zealot. What is that? They should have been more like zealots or something. You know what I mean? Like where there's that they actually it's so
I mean,
easy to
they
convince
do,
them of something.
Yeah, but they I mean, I don't know. They're pretty like zealous. Like, I mean, they have a ritual where they skin like an entire person's upper torso, like pretending they're taking like their shirt off. That's
right.
pretty big deal.
Yeah, it's just to me, it feels like they're doing that more out of fear than out of like a religious ecstasy that they get from it. You know what I mean? And I think the difference there could have gone a long way to making me appreciate that subplot more. Like it feels like Jimmy is just kind of ruling over these people with an iron fist, and several of them, you know, there are a couple of them that are like totally wild-eyed and deranged and feel like they're doing this because they get some sort of kick out of it or something. And I just wish there was either more of that or more of a sense that like these people would be doing this even if Jimmy Crystal died and or like left them or something. Like they had these beliefs instilled in them so deeply that they would still be roaming around and killing people and skinning them alive and all that. Like, not that I would actually want to see that, because that stuff is pretty gnarly in this movie, but just the mentality of these characters, I think I just wish I had a little bit more to grapple with them. But
so I think that's fair, but I also think that the explanation for that lies in the structure of the group, because as we see in this movie, what they do is they go around and they find other people and they terrorize them. but they give certain people a chance to become part of the group in order to survive, just like Spike does at the beginning. And so not everyone in that group is going to be somebody who has been with them for a long time, and much like Spike, likely doesn't as strongly believe and is kind of just along for the ride and surviving because otherwise they know they're going to get killed. So I think the group dynamic does have a good mix of like, yeah, there's a couple people who are hardcore crazy. There's a couple people who are like, yeah, we're here, but like we're also not really sure and like kind of what's going on. And then people like Spike who are brand new and just got in because they happened to luckily kill somebody and make it into the group.
Yeah, that's a good call. There is a lot of turnover in this group. So, okay. So anything else? I guess we should mention that Cillian Murphy's character shows up. I still have never seen the original 28 Days
what?
Later.
What are you doing?
I know. I watched 28 Years Later effectively blind last year because I heard you didn't really have to know much going in. And so I just have not had time to go back and check out the other films. So this that appearance didn't really mean much to me because I obviously didn't see that first film. But for you, because he just appears with his daughter at the very end of the movie for, what, a couple minutes or something, and it's more of a tee-up for what is going to come if the third film in this sort of mini trilogy actually comes to pass. Were you like jazzed about that appearance? Did you feel like it met your expectations, or were you just kind of like, okay, we'll wait and see how it plays out in the next movie?
No, I mean, it's I'm definitely excited to see how it plays out in the next movie. And it was cool to see him show up in that capacity and see that he has survived and has carved out, you know, a pretty normal living situation for himself and his daughter. And I like that he doesn't hesitate to, you know, help Spike and Kelly, as we learn is the female Jimmy's real name. And plus there's you'll figure this out when you see the original movie, which I hope you do sometime soon because it is very good and it holds up. But the music cue at the very end is the same music cue that they use in the original 28 Days Later. So it's it was a nice touch to call back to that.
Excellent. Cool. Well, I think that's it, unless there's anything else you want to say about the Bone Temple.
No, I got boned and it felt good.
All right. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it. All right. That's going to do it for this episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks you heard on this episode. Chris, Brad, and I have a Simpsons rewatch podcast that we just launched not too long ago, and you can find that over there. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, or mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That truly helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show if you can. We'd really appreciate that. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.